Hello, I'm Brian.
And I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
Well, welcome back to the podcast. And welcome back to Claire. We've got the old gang back on the podcast after some holidays and whatnot. Back in your rightful place, Claire.
Yeah.
Cross Power Trio. Woo! Reunited.
Okay, we're just going to dive straight in today. We're probably muttering on too much about lockdown routines and stuff. So top line on the podcast today, Claire, you've got a digital divide type story, kind of digital skills and whatnot.
Yep, just a little talk about digital skills and how the coronavirus pandemic might have affected people's lives in lockdown and their access to digital skills. Yeah. Or something like that. I don't know.
Something like that. Super important topic anyway.
Yeah.
So this week, me and Caroline, we're going to talk about two virtual events that we attended in our respective beats. Quite kind of landmark kind of events, quite big ones. Me, Sapphire, Caroline, it's AWS. What's the title of it?
The AWS Summit Online. No mucking around with that title. You know exactly where you are.
Unlike Sapphire now, Reimagined, which we'll come on to in a bit. And then you're going to take us behind the scenes with the Microsofties.
Yeah, it's an interesting story that came out this week, them sort of providing a bit of a behind-the-scenes look at how they've had to adapt their infrastructure to accommodate the huge surge in people wanting to use Microsoft cloud services of all kinds because of COVID. Again, can't get away from COVID. Sorry, guys.
Microsoft Teams especially, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the big things.
Mm-hmm.
So more on that later. I'm going to close out the podcast with a few comments on Oracle's results very briefly. But we'll start today with Claire. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Take it away.
One of the things that I have been looking into this week is the all-party parliamentary group on digital skills, which was set up in 2019 to sort of raise awareness of the importance of digital skills throughout the government, you know, like make sure that the government is thinking about digital skills when they're making policies and stuff like that. So earlier this week, or by the time the podcast comes out, it will be last week, the All Party Parliamentary Group on Digital Skills launched a call for evidence just to sort of find out about some of the challenges that organisations have been facing during lockdown. And to see whether any of the ways that they've been, you know, like implementing solutions to these problems could help to develop digital skills in the future. So if there's anything, you know, like creative that they might be doing to sort of make sure that people are still able to use the technology that they need during lockdown life. So that was quite interesting because it sort of makes you think about, you know, like this increase in the use of technology to try and navigate work life and home life during, you know, like a time that we can't go outside and go about our lives normally. And there are a number of people who don't have digital skills needed for day-to-day life anyway. So it just sort of makes you think how those people might be affected by the fact that a lot of even basic things are online now, like shopping.
The light on that stuff, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. It sort of makes you think about it. And it sort of connected quite nicely to a piece that our freelancer, Kath Everett, who we've spoken about before, wrote at the beginning of lockdown about how to cope with the digital skills divide, especially since, as I said, a number of people before lockdown even happened didn't have the basic digital skills to navigate day-to-day tasks. Mm-hmm. And Kath cites a Lloyds Banking Group piece of research as well, that pointed out that over half of UK working age people don't have all of the essential digital skills that are considered to like be needed for work as well. So the more that you increase the amount of technology that people are using to, you know, like actually work, the more that you'll start to see, you know, like gaps in people's knowledge or, you know, like gaps in what people are and aren't able to do. That was really interesting. Obviously all of the links will be in the summary, so you should definitely go and read Kath's piece for sure.
Yeah, she's a really good, you know, business journalist. One of the things that occurred to me, Claire, when I was reading your news story about this was it's been like a big experiment. I mean, it's not it's not an experiment, a social experiment you would choose to do, to have us all in lockdown and stuff. But nevertheless, we've done it. So we might as well kind of learn from that.
People adapt to situations when they're under pressure. Yeah. So you're kind of creating the, you know, like this massive creative environment where people have to work around things because there's not necessarily a perfect way to get it done. So yeah, it really has sort of forced a lot of innovation. And like you say, it's not something that we would have chosen, but no. Sometimes in the darkest of times, people come up with the most creative of ideas in a good way.
Imagine though, if someone had just said like a few months ago, like, oh, we're going to run an experiment where everyone's going to be confined to their homes for like extended periods because we just want to test out how people respond to new technologies and stuff like that, and like what technologies have come to the fore. You'd just be like, no, that's mental. That would never happen.
I'm sure there are a bunch of conspiracy theorists online who have pointed out that it's a bit weird.
That thing about half of all workers not having the digital skills that they need, it's just incredible.
But basically, yeah, I don't know what they were defining as essential digital skills needed for work, but there are a number of people who don't have all of them, like they're not a full package.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose when you kind of dig into these things, you think, well, what exactly do they mean by that? But yeah. I think the general drift of it, that people are not as digitally skilled as we might imagine. Yeah, that's the...
It's not to say that they can't be taught quite easily, no. though. Like, it doesn't say what amount of capability they would have to learn those things. It might just be that they've never, you know, like, had to use particular skills or software or something before. I don't know. The report is linked to in Cath's story, so you can go and have a bit of a deeper dive on it if you want to find out exactly what they mean. But I think people aren't going to just walk into a job fully formed having every single skill that they're going to need to, you know, use the technology that those firms have on hand. I mean, like, people use different stuff, don't they? And some people have in-house technology, some people have proprietary software and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's been a big theme of some of your other coverage on skills before as well. And I don't know if it's in your story or Kath's story, but it is a bit worrying that there must be so many school children who are not, you know, they don't have laptops or easy internet access and things like that. So shines a light on that as well, you know, the kids being sent back home and stuff.
You just don't know if they even have access to the internet to be able to receive some of like the daily materials that they need, you know. Because I don't know how it works because I don't have kids, but I'm pretty sure that they're being sort of like emailed class schedules to see, you know, like what they have to do from day to day.
Yeah, a lot of them have like these sort of online learning environments where you do have to log in and sort of download like the work tasks for the day, or they do get emailed them and things like that. But yeah, like it's totally, if you don't have a device that you can access that from, I don't know what provisions are being made by schools. Like, you know, are they sending out physical workbooks so people can still access this stuff? I know there's been a couple of initiatives, some well-meaning tech firms have like bought Chromebooks and donated them to schools that are sort of for disadvantaged kids who don't have access to sort of tablets or, you know, a PC or anything. So a big accessibility challenge for that stuff.
Or what if your guardian doesn't have the technology skills to help you with that, you know? Sometimes kids have, you know, like more technology savvy than adults do. And if you are living with a parent or guardian that doesn't know how to use tech, what are you just supposed to, you know, be the guiding light in that household of how to get everything done during this time? And what support are you getting for that? That would be interesting to look into.
Also, it would be interesting to look into kids who are totally playing that to their advantage. Like, oh no, mum, dad, don't worry. Oh, look, there's no homework today, actually. They said, have a day off. Yeah, let's go outside.
Yeah, they said be in nature today.
I think it's been a really tricky business, this whole schooling. I mean, we can see this with some of our colleagues who do have children, and, you know, they can't join our relatively early morning Zoom call because they're organising the homeschooling, and their pupils are in revolt.
Yeah. So
just refusing to toe the line and do the work. And it sounds like a nightmare.
It's very admirable, anyone who's had to juggle work and homeschooling, but I don't know how anyone's managing it or keeping their sanity.
It's a logistical nightmare. I would imagine. I have no idea.
yeah, my only insights into it are from my sister's kids and also my brother's kids as well. And it is just like, God, like, it just, yeah, I just don't know how they're, like I say, staying sane, really, or any of it, really. Yeah, really, really huge challenge.
Yeah, my experience of this is very vicarious as well. By the end of the day, that, you know, even people who are professionals, they're not teachers. So if there is a digital divide in society, and surely there is, well, Caroline and I listened to a couple of CEOs this week who are definitely on one side of the digital divide, and probably in the top 1% of the socioeconomic population. Christian Klein of SAP, in my case, and
Andy Jassy, CEO of AWS, Amazon Web Services.
And they were speaking virtually this week. How is yours, Caroline? How was Andy?
Logistically, it seems we love to talk logistics. It was actually really good. They gave us, as the press, access to like the keynotes and the sort of fireside chats and stuff in advance of the event. So you could kind of, you know, so you could kind of pick through what you were watching and listening to, and also prepare your work, like your write-ups in advance of the actual show in a couple of days' time. But that was, I think that's quite good, because also it helps you manage your time a bit more. At the moment we are...
Yeah.
It's, you know, there's a lot of competition for different virtual events, actually, sometimes on the same day to tune into. So if you kind of manage your time and just sort of, oh, okay, they've given me this in advance, I'll watch it when it's convenient to me, not necessarily when it's happening live, and then I can still get my write-ups done in time. It does make things a lot easier. And I think also it just makes maybe the quality of what you're writing up a bit better. You're not under so much stress or duress to get it written up before the end of the keynote, or, you know, as that kind of thing.
Oh, I see what you mean. Mm. Yeah, no, that sounds really handy. Because I mean, I sat down to the SAP keynote. So this is it. This is Sapphire reimagined virtual realm. And the keynote was on Monday. It was pre-recorded, right? Mm. Christian Klein, and it was his first Sapphire keynote as CEO of SAP. So Bill McDermott, the previous CEO, stepped down last year in, I think, November. Might be wrong about the timing on that. And they appointed two CEOs, Jennifer Morgan, who's American, who was running their cloud business, and Christian Klein, who was chief operating officer. And he still is chief operating officer as well. He's doing two jobs.
Oh, okay.
Around Easter... Jennifer Morgan stepped down, so we had a woman CEO of SAP for a brief period of time, and then she stood down. Apparently, well, the kind of rationale for this was better to have one head than two heads during a pandemic crisis. So it just made things more efficient, I think, was the thinking that they had. So this was Christian's first go at this, and it was a complete fiasco because no one could access the keynote through the event website, you know, through SAP's official channels, the Sapphire website. So the Twitter sphere was just going nuts with journalists and analysts, you know, saying, how can we access? And not to mention real people, like civilians, trying to access the keynote as well. I think I got to the keynote through, in fact, I know I got to the keynote through Ray Wang, who's an analyst, who's a very prolific tweeter, and he put up a Periscope link. So we were able to follow the keynote through that feed. And I think there was a Twitter feed that you could follow it through as well.
Is Periscope, is that the live streaming one that all the kids these days are using?
Yeah, yeah. So that was how I got to see it.
Hmm.
I mean, there was all sorts of things. I think you noticed this, Caroline, didn't you, about people having those like pre-recorded, pre-packaged tweets that were going in. You know, good point, well made and stuff. And
yeah, like, yeah, these guys are smashing it. Like, where? How? Like, how do we know? No one can get into it. Quite funny. I don't know. I haven't obviously attended every single virtual tech conference that happened, but that does seem to be the first one we've had so far that has had a bit of a bumpy start to it, doesn't it? I think something that maybe all the others probably just like, oh, by, you know, there, for the grace of God, go on.
I've met Christian Klein a few times, like before his elevation to this role. And I did feel a bit sorry for him. I think he was pretty angry about the whole thing as well, because he did a Q&A with journalist Sam the next day, in which he did say he was quite angry, but he'd calmed down since then, and today was another day, and so on and so forth. And he had to take responsibility for having engaged a third-party platform provider to do it.
I think it does just highlight that people are human, though. I mean,
yeah.
Sometimes your cat walks across the keyboard. Sometimes you've left yourself on mute and you forget. You just got to calm down, chill out. Everybody's in the same boat, you know?
Yeah. And yeah, it's, I guess for him though, with it being his first one as CEO, there's probably quite a lot of pressure. And also Sapphire is their flagship event. So it's your first time. Yeah.
It's a massive event. Yeah.
But he's the CEO, so no one's going to take the piss out of him if he gets it wrong like they are other people, are they? They're not going to be like, ah, look what happened.
yeah, true.
It must be quite a tough gig for him, though. He's quite young. I think he's now 40, so he has turned 40, but he was like 39 when he got that role. And he's still being chief operating officer as well. He is a nice fella, he's smart, he's very humane and empathic and stuff, so you know, yeah, good luck to him. But it was embarrassing.
Only if you let it be.
Yeah, lean into it. This is how all SAP conference is going to be. That's what I'd be like, so get used to it, strap in. Anything can happen.
The actual keynote itself was, in terms of production values, it was really high end. It was like film level graphics and.
Oh really?
Mm. Yeah, and he was wearing a white t-shirt and white trainers, with a blazer, I think, or a suit.
Was he still doing like the, I don't know, you know when you're at a physical tech conference and the CEO does like a sort of, they stroll around the stage as they talk. Was he still doing any of that business? Because I'm just worried about all these tech CEOs now, what their Fitbit step counts are going to be like. Now they can't walk across stages making their big pronouncements about stuff.
Yeah, there's no stairs to run up.
This is true. I think he was quite static, if I remember correctly. He was moving his hands a fair bit. I mean, he clearly put a lot, there's a lot had gone into preparing this. Mm. And he had a customer from Porsche on stage, and he was also wearing a white t-shirt and white trainers, so it's the look. I'm not sure if I'm going to go down that route myself.
It's a brave look.
The content of the keynote itself was, it was good. Kind of at the second pass I went back and listened to it again properly, and he kind of led on sustainability, resilience, how SAP's technology can help you through this kind of crisis, but also very much talking about climate change as being the big context challenge. So it was very high level, quite abstract, all about the intelligent enterprise, which has been a kind of a theme for SAP for a while. But usually when Bill McDermott does these things, he's such a salesman, he's up there selling something. So whether it's like last year, he was selling the value of Qualtrics, and we've spoken about that on the podcast before, X data and O data, experience data and operational data. The year before that, it was C4HANA. So it was all that kind of customer relationship management and customer experience stuff. And then I can go back and go back and go back. But I mean, basically, Bill would be selling something that you could buy in a fairly straightforward sort of way, as well as doing quite a big picture thing. But this was more conceptual. It's about how enterprises can become as intelligent as human beings are, like a kind of organic being that can sense its environment and it can reach into its supply chain and reach out to its customers and so on and so forth. I mean, it's the sort of thing that I sit there and think, this is just BS. How can you possibly do that? I took a briefing yesterday from a big SAP customer, Vodafone. So spoke to gentlemen there in the kind of corporate, you know, Vodafone, Holger Gruver, who's the group head of corporate transformation, and Ignacio Garcia, who's CIO for corporate systems. So very senior, I would have thought very hard bitten, been around the blocks, been there, done that, seen it all. So I was asking them about the intelligent enterprise and they loved it. They said, yeah, that's absolutely what we want to hear from SAP. And, you know, we're an intelligent enterprise too. Da-da-da-da-da. So, you know, maybe it's a good approach. But the thing is, it's going to be so hard for people to really digest what was the content of the keynote, given the fiasco.
Yeah.
It sounds like the AWS event was... Actually, that sounds nice, the way they package that up. And
getting advanced access to stuff definitely helped. But then our colleague Adrian Bridgewater was on Twitter saying that he's had some virtual conferences where because everything is pre-recorded, they will just give you the keynote if you agree to sort of embargoes and stuff. But also that they will send you a transcript of what's going to get talked about as well ahead of time now, because everything's pre-recorded, which is like, oh my God. But yeah, it depends on what conference you go to. But yeah, it is interesting though. Like I say, you're sort of sitting, it is a different experience. And the AWS conference, they had Amazon CTO Werner Vogel sort of giving a keynote, and he was sort of just sat in his living room. And you're sort of a bit like, okay, sort of making sort of, cloud, it's big guys, all that kind of stuff, the usual stuff. But sort of talking about actually kind of how, you know, COVID is sort of causing people to accelerate their adoption and use of cloud technologies, which is great news for AWS. But also he was sort of advising people to like, sort of, you know, use this time, this sort of quiet time, to go and maybe tweak your cloud deployments, make sure they're most efficient as they can be, and you know, use this time to skill up and, you know, maybe get into machine learning and AI. I was like, oh yeah, because that's like a lockdown skill we can all just pick up, isn't it? So there was kind of, that was kind of his talking points. But yeah, it's a different style. Usually when you see him in particular at, say, reInvent, which is AWS's big flagship annual show, which happens at the end of each year, he's sort of bouncing around the stage. He's very kind of very active, kind of very engaging, very charismatic guy. And like I say, just full of energy. So seeing him sort of just sat there presenting straight down the camera was a very different experience. So definitely brings a different energy to everything. And Andy Jassy, meanwhile, was kind of very much towing the sort of the usual kind of talking points with AWS. You know, people need to do more in cloud, says the guy who owns the biggest cloud platform going. You know, if you're not fast with this, you'll be last with this, and you'll be, you know, another take on the kind of, if you're not getting into cloud now, your business will suffer and all that kind of stuff. It's just, to steal a phrase from a well-known Disney film, it's a tale as old as time now. I've been writing that story quite a few times. But I did write it up. He basically told enterprise they've got to stop trying to fight gravity by resisting cloud, which I did write. My first ever story writing as a tech journalist was basically along those lines, but for channel people, saying like, embrace cloud or die. So it's just another take on that 10 years on.
It's funny because I always thought that the apocalypse would force people to go back to the skills that they had before technology, but it turns out that it's actually forced us to adopt more technology and then have people advise us to gain machine learning skills during lockdown. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's gone the other way. Shouldn't have spent so much time learning how to whittle. I never did that.
Well, I think it's like a tale of two different apocalypses. There's so many people like, oh, I'm making banana bread, I'm going to grow my own. This guy's like, no, get into AI. Actually start building the things that are going to steal your future jobs. Like, no, I don't want to
do that.
No way. Yeah, the future's scary enough as it is.
I managed to grow my own hair. That's
good.
Looking good.
SAP, for the kind of cloud infrastructure provisioning bit of its business, relies on what it calls the hyperscalers. Caroline, is that a term that everybody uses, hyperscalers, for AWS? And
I use it a lot. It's usually just a sort of like a shorthand to describe like the size of their business and infrastructure. So the hyperscalers are all these people who run, in my world of cloud data, who run these sort of mega data centers, absolutely huge, just facilities. So they're called the hyperscalers. And then you might get like a company come along, oh, we're a hyperscaler, we've got a big data. No, nah, it's not big enough, you're not a hyperscaler, move on. So yeah, it tends to be used as, like, say, shorthand to denote the size of the infrastructure powering their services.
And Alibaba, they're a hyperscaler.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The SAP.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. There with a bullet. Yeah, that's them.
And one of the hyperscalers is also Microsoft with Azure. Caroline, you noticed some blog commentary which you wrote up around Microsoft and what they're doing, have been doing behind the scenes.
Going back to sort of the AWS commentary a little bit as well, you know, sort of a talking point that's come out of COVID recently is that we've heard loads of anecdotal reports about how the lockdown induced sort of work from home mandates are sort of prompting CIOs and tech leaders sort of maybe speed up their digital transformation plans, but also in many cases sort of hasten their move to cloud. So AWS, Microsoft are all sort of benefiting from these trends. And that was, like I say, at the AWS summit this week, Andy Jassy was talking a little bit about the surge in demand his company have seen from existing customers wanting to do more in the cloud as a result of COVID, but also how its infrastructure is supporting sort of other cloud-based companies who are now having to deal with sort of massive and unprecedented sort of spikes in user numbers, as you know, as so many of us are working from home, but also in the evenings when, you know, the long nights of lockdown get to us all, we're all sort of tuning into Netflix, Amazon Prime and stuff like that. According to Andy Jassy, pretty much all of the major streaming services, for example, run on the AWS cloud. So Netflix, Amazon Prime, Disney Plus and Hulu in the US. But also they prop up part of the infrastructure for things like Zoom as well, although Oracle does bits as well. So he was sort of saying, like, oh, you know, we're actually propping up like the whole of like the business community and consumers as well, getting them through COVID. But then, yeah, like I say, Microsoft published some blogs this week where it's also like, AWS, you are doing all of that, but Microsoft are kind of doing it a bit more directly, like as far as I'm concerned. Basically, so Microsoft's core cloud offerings, you know, they do span infrastructure, so Azure, as you said, Brian, but also they have business productivity services with Office 365 and collaboration, cloud-based collaboration with Teams. But also on the consumer side, they've got Xbox, the Xbox Business and Network, which is all run out of Microsoft's own cloud data centers. So with this surge in people having to work online and use cloud services, you know, Microsoft's seeing a huge uptick in like sort of demand for cloud services running out of its data centers, both on the business side and consumer side. So these blog posts they shared had some really interesting sort of metrics around how, say, for example, on the consumer side, the Xbox network, the number of concurrent users on there at the moment or sort of during the pandemic has been on a par with when they have like a big new game release. And it's just sort of like, oh my God, we're having to deal with these sort of massively inflated numbers of users and people trying to use cloud services on the consumer side out of our data centers. But then at the same time, they've got the same thing happening with Office 365, but also Teams as well. And it's so this blog post was sort of kind of going through some of the numbers on that, but also just kind of lifting the lid a little bit on how, like, what that looks like at a data center level as well, and some of the steps they've had to take to make sure they've got enough capacity to meet this just massive spikes in demand that, you know, a few months ago no one could have predicted were going to happen. Over the course of the pandemic, there has been a run on all of Microsoft services essentially. Yeah. And at times they have run into technical difficulties, which is something Andy Jassy kind of he didn't mention Microsoft by name, but he did have a bit of a, you know, not some cloud providers haven't been able to, you know, handle all the traffic they've seen during the pandemic. You know, we're not one of them, but you know, Microsoft has had issues. We reported on it. There was, I think at the start of April, there were cloud users in Europe who were trying to access resources on Azure, and they kept getting like, oh, there's not enough capacity, you can't run your workloads in Azure at this time. And they were having to sort of mitigate that by trying to sort of, they'd introduce things to sort of meter access to its cloud to sort of high priority groups. If you were using like the free tier of their cloud service, you weren't able to access it because they needed to prioritize demand. So all of that stuff was going on. But basically, to ensure that didn't become the norm during the pandemic, they had to kind of roll out sort of changes to the way they operated. And this blog post sort of goes into behind the scenes. What does that look like from a data center level. And the thing that really just jumped out at me was they said they had to embark on a 24-hour cycle of just putting new data center hardware into their facilities and their hardest hit facilities that were the biggest demand they were seeing. And you just kind of, and it's just like round the clock, just like quick, more servers, having to actually physically put more servers in every time, like there's a rush of users on Xbox or something like that. That's more, yeah, that's more servers somewhere else along like this weird kind of digital food chain. And it's just like the image of that to me was just like, it's like a worker bee colony or something, like more, you know, more input. But at the same time, trying to keep up with that demand while adhering to social distancing. They were saying like all our workers have had to be 6 feet apart while they're doing this work. So you're having to work at a massively increased pace while also very safely trying to sort of make sure that no one passes on any infections or anything like that. And it's, yeah, like I say, it's just a really interesting behind the scenes look. And it's not something you get, you're often treated to, which is why like I found it really interesting. We said a few times on the podcast before, you know, the data center industry operates under like a veil of secrecy for its own reasons, you know, for security and things like that. So getting kind of this kind of level of insight into, so when a pandemic hits, what does like a surge in use in a data center, what does that look like? It's, yeah, to sort of a data center nerd like me, that kind of stuff is really, really interesting to hear. And one of the stats they shared was something like in March, basically, they the number of minutes that people booked or used Teams for hit a peak of 2.7 billion meeting minutes on this single day in March, and that's a record. And then the following month, in April, that hit 4.1 billion. So that is just giving you a kind of just a level of just how quickly things have changed.
It's incredible, isn't it? It's so interesting that, I mean, they're, you know, they're provisioning Teams.
Yeah.
You know, it's within all of that is within their technology stack.
Yeah. And it's a bit like we were talking about the Chelsea Flower Show last week. They were having to do deliver a virtual show for the first time while all working remotely under completely new working conditions. And the same is true of, say, Microsoft. They would all be working from home, trying to sort of coordinate, oh my God, how do we keep all of these services online with all of these people, you know, with all these people relying on us? And it's, yeah, it really makes you sit back and just think of the huge, massive undertaking that these tech firms are under or having to embark on at the moment in these very strange times.
Yeah, and our colleague Cliff Sarin has used the word hero quite a bit of professionals working under and through these circumstances.
Yeah.
Pretty opposite, rightly so.
It will make me think twice, I think, you know, when I load up my Xbox tonight, like, oh, do I really want to do that? Like, because I don't want to end up like ruining some data center engineer's evening by, oh, you've got to put another server in. Oh, maybe tonight I'll leave Call of Duty alone and just find something else to do. Or maybe load up Netflix and make it AWS's problem. I don't know. It's, yeah, it just makes you think, like say, just about the food chain of it all a bit more. Yeah. So, which is important to do because, again, like say, the data center industry, one of its you know, biggest criticisms is it is so secretive. And because no one knows it exists, they don't always get like kudos or the sort of, you know, respect that, you know, they demand, keeping the world ticking over at the moment. It's worth having a read through, like I say, we're living through this at the moment and just getting an insight into how the machine, like a machine the size of Microsoft, is having to adapt and change the way it works. And just on the hoof, it sounds like as well, just learning as they're going along. There's quite an interesting insight shared in it about how they couldn't predict, obviously, like with the huge rise in Teams, like how many people are we going to have, you know, using Teams on a Monday morning in Europe? So they were having to, they created like a team that kind of tries to predict that based on telemetry data that comes off Teams in Microsoft, who have to sit there and think, okay, so this country is, say, 2 weeks behind Italy. In Italy, Teams usage spiked like this during this point of the pandemic. So maybe we need to move some resources around and make sure, you know, this country's got, you know, in case they see a similar change in behaviour and stuff like that. Like I say, it's just really, really fascinating. But I'm a nerd, so I might find stuff like that fascinating. I don't know.
At TechTarget, we use Teams a little bit. I don't think the three of us do particularly, but they do use it quite a bit in the US. Because what we do use is Zoom. how we're doing this podcast. And as Larry Ellison would tell you, Oracle has rescued Zoom, because they did a big in the last quarter of their financial year. Their results came out this week, did Oracle's, and not great results, really. Revenue down 1%, revenue in the quarter down about 6%. I think Safra Catz said they'll get all that money back. You know, send the debt collectors round or whatever. There's some late payments going on there. But still, I mean, you know, they still make an enormous amount of money. I mean, 10.4 billion in that last quarter. So, you know, it's a big piggy bank. But Larry doesn't really talk about the numbers, but he talks about how marvelous the Oracle Autonomous Database is. How autonomous is a quote from Larry. This is on the investors call around the release of the numbers. Autonomy is the defining technology that separates our Gen 2 cloud from Amazon's, Microsoft's, and Google's Generation 1 cloud. To summarize, Oracle's Gen 2 autonomous, serverless, elastic cloud infrastructure delivers better performance, higher security, at a much lower cost than AWS, Azure, or the Google Cloud. And that's why we won Zoom.
It's interesting, actually, because like I say, Zoom, like, as I mentioned previously, were mentioned as a reference customer by Andy Jassy. And just as you said that oh, it's going to come up in the thing, I pulled up his quote that he said, and he was like, a lot of people use Zoom, and the vast majority of Zoom's cloud infrastructure runs on AWS and will for the foreseeable future. So it's like, oh, tug of love over Zoom. Larry versus Andy, who will win?
I mean, I wrote up the Zoom Oracle deal originally. Oh, that was a difficult thing to do, right? But anyway, I wrote it up. And almost immediately, the Zoom PR got in touch and said, oh, hang on. Zoom still uses, we want to make it clear, we're still using AWS. We're still using Microsoft Azure. It's not an exclusive deal with Oracle for its Oracle Cloud infrastructure. That will cut noise with Larry.
Fight. That's what I say.
He is a character. And I think that's why a lot of journalists like to write about Oracle. You know, it's because of those that kind of big personality of Larry Ellison. Very, very boastful.
Yeah, I think, yeah, you do need characters. I mean, how many, you know, we go to so many tech conferences and then the CEO could just be, well, a lot of time just any like dude in a suit, couldn't it? And it's you need something to sort of make you stand out and, you know, just make it a bit more interesting. But also someone who can carry the users along with them. Like, oh, you know, why do I say this? But they've got confidence, they've got charisma, we'll keep buying their technology because... Gen 2, it's amazing. Listen to that guy. I want more of that cloud.
More than that.
Yeah, makes life a bit more interesting.
That mix of soft and technical skills.
He is entertaining. He's a very entertaining speaker. He's quite funny. And I think he always jokes that he does his own slides. And you can kind of tell that he does his own slides. but I mean, he is what he is. Incredibly wealthy individual and so on, and quite entertaining. So the virtual conferences that I've got coming up in the near future are among some smaller fish, certainly smaller than SAP, AWS, Microsoft and Oracle. So next week I've got Databricks' conference, Spark and AI Summit. It's called that because the founders of Databricks invented Spark, which is an open source big data technology. I quite like Databricks. The guys who founded it are super smart, from Berkeley, quite geeky and nerdy and stuff. And they're moving. They're now getting to a stage where their company is becoming a bigger piece in Silicon Valley. So that's the thing I've got going on next week. How about you two? Have you got any events coming up next week?
I haven't got any virtual events next week. I've got a couple towards the end of June, including another AWS one, the public sector summit, I think June the 30th. But no, I haven't. I'm hoping because of that, because there's been a real a load of them, one after the other, for me the last few weeks. Hopefully the next couple of weeks will enable me to finally get some of my longer write-ups written, just knuckle down and get them written. But the news gods dictate whether or not I can do that. So yeah,
we'll see. For virtual conferences. Claire, you got, I think you were saying before the podcast, you had something coming up next week.
Yeah, so there's a We Are the City conference next week, which is sort of like a women in tech focused thing, which should be good.
Cool. Well, sadly, I think that's all we've got time for this week. Just remains me to say, as usual, thank you very much to Caroline.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much to Claire.
Anytime.
And thank you very much to you for listening. Stay safe. Bye.
Bye. Bye.